This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 10th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 246. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. Daryl Plekis and Alan Mullen react to the sentencing of disgraced former BC legislature clerk Craig James. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is it worth hosting another Winter Olympics in Vancouver? The Canadian Olympic Committee and leaders of the four host First Nations from the 2010 Games think it is. On July 8th, they released cost estimates for the $4 billion project. At least $1 billion would be needed from taxpayers. I say at least because the cost estimates did not put a price tag to things like ambulance services, garbage and recycling, snow removal, and traffic control. Like one half of the Olympic motto, Vancouverites learned in 2010 that Olympic costs always rise higher and faster than the boosters let on. I asked some questions about who came up with the numbers and who will pay if Vancouver hosts the 2030 Games, which are being marketed as an Indigenous-led project. The voices you will hear in response to my questions are Mary Conabare, former Vancouver 2010 Games Operations Manager, and Chris Lewis, the Squamish Nation's Director of Indigenous Initiatives and Reconciliation.
You say that the Olympic Village cost for all the Olympic Village cost would be $267 million for 2030. The Vancouver Village in 2010, which went through a lot of financial upheaval, cost $1.1 billion. You've got security for 2030 at half the cost of 2010. Olympics have a history of low budget estimates and rising costs. And for 2010, the big story was the recession, which really turned things upside down for VanOck and the sponsors and broadcasters. There were a lot of cutbacks, and the government had to put in more money. These are all costs that the public would bear, and the COEC has already expressed privately that it doesn't want a referendum. But you are saying that you've consulted with third-party consultants to back up your assertions here in this report. So what are the names of those third-party consultants? Did you have an architect or engineer consult? You know, who was that? What are their names? What are their qualifications?
Thanks, Bob. It's Mary speaking. So we put the security names up on the website, and we can put up the bios of the other. There's a lot of people involved, so rather than rattling them off, we'll put them up on the website, I think. But yes, the answer you said is it engineers, it's a cost consultant. So it's professional consultant who looks at these kinds of costs. When we look at the security, we have it validated by actual security law enforcement members. And so in every case, it's people with a great pedigree, but we can put that up on the website for sure.
More than 24 hours after the July 8th news conference, the gamesengagement.ca website includes bios for four security consultants led by Alphonse McNeil, a 38-year veteran of the RCMP who was in charge of security for the 2010 G8 and G20 summits. But there were still no names of any engineering or architecture consultants.
You're asking for at least $1 billion from taxpayers at this time. It's a very difficult time to be asking for that much because the healthcare system and social housing are both in crisis. There's a lot of homelessness here in Vancouver, especially downtown east side. Recently, BC Tourism and Sport Minister Melanie Mark sent a letter to Tricia Smith giving an August 15th deadline for the COC to provide details about costs and risks. In her letter, she wants to know how all parties, not just municipal governments, but the First Nations, how all parties, each and every one of them, would share in the costs and risks. There's concerns about who would actually underwrite the games if there were any deficits. The IOC wants to have a guarantor. Because you're calling this an Indigenous-led bid for what would be an Indigenous-led games, do any of the four host First Nations propose to put their own money into the organizing committee or put their own financial future at risk? And if so, how much would that be? And I'm wondering if I could get an answer from each leader, from Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, and Liliuokwe, if they can each answer on behalf of their First Nations.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. It's Satoctin here, Chris Lewis, and thank you for the question. And I really, we all know that we have a housing crisis here. We have a homeless crisis here in Vancouver. And this is really about unlocking the economic potential of the host nations. As you know, we have 90 acres of land at Jericho that we had to purchase back as Indigenous peoples to start economic development. And now we're offering our own parcels of land for a little bit of time to build the Athletes Village, because we know that we need to welcome the world. We need to create economic opportunity and hope to meet the housing demands and the housing crisis in Vancouver. The city of Vancouver also requires us to do that, but we're going to go further on and ensure that we're leveraging not only our funds, federal, provincial funds, but also external funds to ensure that we're moving forward in the right way. And that's kind of how we're moving forward. And that's kind of what we're putting in. And we're also providing certainty to this region. We know that Indigenous issues, if it's on major projects or any of those things, creates uncertainty to outside investors into the region. By having this Indigenous led, is that we're creating certainty for these games. We're telling the world, come and invest into this region, into this province, into this country, so that we can move forward in a good way and tackle those problems that we have. By hosting the world, we kind of illuminate some of those things like the climate crisis and all of those other things that we need to move forward. We unlock that potential. So I think this is a really good thing. And that's kind of how we're moving forward together. And we're all going to have to do it together, Bob. It's not just the Indigenous nations. It's all levels of government, including others that are going to come and help us as well. Thank you.
Vancouver City Council is expecting a staff presentation on July 20th before deciding whether to support the bid. The BC NDP government has given the Canadian Olympic Committee until August 15th to deliver a mini business plan before deciding whether to support the bid too. Salt Lake City and Sapporo, Japan are also considering bids. The International Olympic Committee wants to make a decision by May 2023. Read more on thebreaker.news. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. Disgraced former BC legislature clerk Craig James was sentenced July 8th to 1 month of house arrest in his Saanich home and 2 months of 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew. Associate Chief Justice Heather Holmes found James guilty of fraud and breach of public trust in May. He was sentenced only to breach of public trust because of rulings against multiple convictions for the same circumstances. The Crown wanted a year in jail or a combination of house arrest and curfew for James, who was the equivalent of chief executive at the seat of government from 2011 to 2018. James's lawyers wanted a conditional discharge and community service work. In BC Supreme Court, Holmes rejected both conditional discharge and jail for James. While he is a 71-year-old with no prior criminal record, James also filed false expense claims for $1,900 worth of custom shirts and a suit. He was ordered to pay restitution. Joining me on the Breaker.news podcast for their reaction is former Speaker Daryl Plekis and his former Chief of Staff Alan Mullen. They uncovered the corruption of the BC legislature, which led to the suspensions of Craig James and Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz. First up, Daryl Plekis.
Do you think that the place and time fits the crime? He is going to be spending time during the summer at his house. He will be allowed to leave to go to church every week, to go grocery shopping and medical appointments. But otherwise, the next month, he's got to stay at his home in Saanich. And then after that, he has a curfew for 2 months. Does the place and time fit the crime?
Well, I guess the first thing I would like to say is if I had a bias, it would be towards what was recommended by the prosecution. I think, at least in my mind, the most important thing in this matter is that of denunciation of the offense and deterrence. Like, others need to understand that this is, as the judge said, it's very, very serious, and people need to be deterred from doing anything like this in the future. And the denunciation part is, you know, exemplifies how serious it is. So if you say that's, you know, the primary issue, it surprised me that he didn't get some jail time. When I think of other cases, I mean, remembering he was the most senior official in a very, very important public institution, would ordinarily be expected to be set an example for others. And of course, that just didn't happen. So, but of course, I respect the judge's decision. I'm also reminded that, you know, there is the sentence part, but he's also suffers the consequence of a criminal record, which has all kinds of consequences on its own. He lost his employment. He lost his massive income of $357,000 a year as a consequence of all of this. But going back to the beginning of, you know, what my primary concern was, and my chief of staff is, you know, as working for taxpayers, if you will, was trying to bring forward the fact that there was wrongdoing, and having it explored, investigated to the point where there was some accountability if it needed to be there. And it's so disquieting that it took so long for that to happen. So that was disturbing. That, you know, it took over 4 years, as you know, and then millions of dollars, like in court costs and police costs. That whole business, if you say you go through an exercise that takes over 4 years and costs, you know, millions of dollars, to end up with this result, it's a bit depressing. It's a bit disquieting, and I can't believe that the average British Columbian would look at this and say that, you know, this really fits to what you know, fits the crime. But again, I at the same time, I do appreciate that the judge is taking into account all kinds of mitigating factors, age, etc. He had references, although I would challenge some of that, because I think the fact that judge herself found and stated during the summation of the trial that, you know, his behavior in his job was irresponsible, reckless. He was, you know, he was not a good guardian of the public trust. So, you know, you it's hard to know that and then say, oh, he's a good guy, and therefore he should be given some kind of break. You know, I think it's always important once somebody receives their punishment that, you know, that we all as a community and as a society be as helpful as we can to somebody, and, you know, at the expiration of their sentence and welcome them back into the community. But that shouldn't take away from consequences that should be included in the first instance. So I guess in short, I would say, I'm not sure that, you know, the penalty was as serious as I think it ought to have been, and obviously the prosecution thought it ought to have been more significant as well. So, but it is what it is.
Alan, does the place and time fit the crime?
I mean, if I'm being honest, Bob, I would say no, it doesn't. You know, I get why it happened, why we got to this place, and why ultimately Associate Chief Justice Holmes came to that conclusion. So I would never question that. But a short answer to your question is no, I don't think it does. And I don't think it deters, you know, this future behavior, you know, from elected or appointed officials.
Is this sentence enough
when it comes to the financial penalties?
No, in Chief Justice Holmes' verdict, as well as this past Monday when Crown and Defence were giving their submissions, she made a point of referencing the so-called retirement benefit or retirement allowance. And she went into great detail to point out that in her view, there was no basis for that. He wasn't entitled to it. He should never have gotten it. He was in a conflict of interest. And recall back when former Supreme Court Justice Beverly McLaughlin did her investigation, she found the same thing. And she said there was no basis in law whatsoever for that payment. So to me, she didn't find criminality. That's a very high bar. But her comments really set the stage for the basis for a civil suit. And if the province had, an appetite to take a civil suit to recover that money back to British Columbians taxpayers, I believe they would win. It's based on a balance of probabilities. I mean, here you have two judges saying, look, it should never have happened. So I hope they have an appetite to do that. I think British Columbians deserve to get that money back. It should never have been, given out in the first place. So we need that money back. And that was always a huge point for me. So I hope the province now looks at that and takes note and says, look, we're going to do the right thing. We need to get this right. We're going to get our money back.
I don't think we can say with a straight face that the taxpayer has been made whole. We had Chief Justice McLaughlin, the retired Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, stated in her investigation that there was no legal basis for him to receive that money. And then we had, in the current case, Justice Holmes saying that he was in a conflict of interest in receiving the money. So we have two very, very senior judges who have concluded that he shouldn't have got the money. At very least, there should be some exploration of having him pay that back, because just because it wasn't criminal doesn't mean that he should keep it, because there still is the matter. If it's inappropriate, it's civilly, one would think the legislature could sue and should sue for the benefit of taxpayers to get that money back. And any other monies that were obtained as a consequence of inappropriate response to policies or lack of policies, where it was in effect doing the taxpayers out of taxpayers' money. So it's not saying it's criminal. I mean, and she wouldn't be able, the judge wouldn't be able to do that in sentencing. But in as much as she herself mentioned it more than once, and again mentioned previously by McLaughlin in her investigation, I guess I would ask as a taxpayer, like, well, why isn't somebody asking for that money back? Or at least having an investigation as to whether or not it should be paid back. Maybe that civil investigation would conclude that he shouldn't pay it back. But on the face of it right now, when we have two judges who've concluded that he wasn't entitled to it properly, I think there should be some effort for that money to be paid back.
Does this go far enough?
I don't think it does at all. And maybe it's just that, it's not the judge's fault in this case. It's the system, right? It's what's allowed, within the law, and the penalties we have for these offenses. But I think every single taxpayer has an expectation and should expect that anyone who's elected to office or anyone who's serving in government should be implicitly honest and should be going out of their way, if you will, to make sure that there's nothing untoward going on in terms of how dollars are spent, and certainly not being party to any misspending, untoward activity. So if you say to somebody, look, you're going to do this, and if you get caught, you're number one, you're not likely to go to jail. Because here we have the most senior official didn't go to jail. It's hard to imagine who's going to go to jail. This case will be used for future cases, and courts will be reminded that here's a case of somebody who didn't go to jail, and especially in light of the fact where the judge noted that it hit at the heart of breach of trust. So basically saying it's right at the heart of the problem, and you're still not going to jail. Now, of course, in Canada, we very reluctantly send people to jail unless you're a threat to the community, and there is no other alternative, except in cases where you say you have to demonstrate that the behavior is such that you have to set an example, that people have to know you engage in this behavior and there will be a serious consequence. I don't think anybody could say this has been a serious consequence. So that's where I think it's unfortunate. And, perhaps if we had, stricter writing of the law around breach of trust, then it wouldn't be the case. I mean, it's certainly looser now than it ever used to be. Like it used to be the case at one time, if you're convicted of breach of trust, you are absolutely going to jail. So that's not the case anymore. And with an understanding that, of course, we don't want people to go to jail unless it's absolutely essential. But there are certain offenses which should be regarded as so important, so critical, that jail is appropriate. And, we live in a world where it seems increasingly so that it's difficult to find people who have the moral compass necessary to behave in a manner where you just know they're not going to get caught up in breach of trust. So I would say it's more important than ever. More and more we see cases where people sort of brush it off. You know yourself, as this investigation moved on, lots of people were saying, what's the big deal? It's just a little, it's only $1,800. It's not something that deserves a whole bunch of serious attention. And that's really, really unfortunate. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's a judgment call. And of course the judges, make that with the greatest amount of care. Again, I'm sure she considered all manner of mitigating circumstances. But against that, I'm reminded again, the prosecutor didn't see it that way.
Does this sentence send a strong enough message to those people that need to hear that message?
In a word, Bob, no. I wish I could say yes. We went through a lot. We put a lot of work into this. We were sort of raked over the coals. And at the end of the day, no, I don't think it does. Because, here you have an individual saying, well, thank you very much. Here's $1,800 back and I'll stay home for a month and I'll go about my day. And I'm reminded, too, that Craig James's pension is at least double, if not triple, what most British Columbians make over a 2 or 3 year period. So there is no deterrent. Yes, he was, obviously vilified in the media and was scrutinized. But at the end of the day, that goes with the position in any public office, myself included or Darrell Plex included. But I don't think it deters anybody. It's business as usual. And I think there is another shoe to drop here. Certainly at the BC legislature, but in sort of municipal and provincial politics generally, people don't have an appetite for this kind of stuff anymore. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I think there's more to come. So all I would say to you, Bob, and to your listeners and to British Columbians, stay tuned.
That was Alan Mullen and before him Daryl Plekis with their reaction to the July 8th sentencing of disgraced former BC Legislature Clerk Craig James for breach of public trust. Read more on thebreaker.news.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, China predicts 2,000 Taiwanese will attend Cross-Strait Forum, event to open July 12th in Xiamen, China. China's Taiwan Affairs Office said representatives of Taiwan's political parties had been invited to the 14th edition of the event. The 43 events at the forum would be grouped around four themes, including youth, grassroots, economic and cultural exchanges, but it failed to provide information about the background of the guests from Taiwan. In Mainichi News, ex-mayor's pricey office desk and chair fetched $22,000 at online auction in Japan. Mayor Ko Tanaka, who beat Hirotami Mirakoshi in the March 2022 mayoral election, had decided to sell the set after the hefty purchase price was criticized in the municipal assembly. The city bought the desk and chair for $15,000 to coincide with the partial opening of the new city hall in August 2020. The mayor vowed that the city will not misuse taxpayers' money in the future. In the Hong Kong Free Press, disclosing media invite list for July 1st leadership inauguration would harm Hong Kong's security, government claims. The Information Services Department rejected an access to information request lodged by the Hong Kong Free Press after the authorities effectively barred several local and international mainstream media outlets from covering events surrounding the inauguration and the 25th anniversary of the handover from UK to China. Outlets from Japan, Taiwan, and the US were not invited. Applications for access from the South China Morning Post, Ming Pao, and Reuters were refused. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, monkeypox not a threat to World Athletics Championship attendees, health officials say, even as they raise alarms about cases in Oregon. As of Thursday, Oregon had six potential cases of the disease, five of them waiting for confirmation from federal health officials. That is almost certainly an undercount. The risk to the thousands of people expected to come for the World Athletics Championships in Eugene from July 15th to 24th is low, though not zero. On King 5, tsunami waves would reach Seattle within minutes after earthquake, study finds. Washington state officials urged Seattleites to be prepared for a tsunami, even though the last known earthquake on the Seattle Fault occurred about 1,100 years ago. The study also found flooding from such a tsunami would exceed 20 feet along Seattle's shoreline. The DNR said the study found waves may travel up to 3 miles inland at the Port of Tacoma, although flooding would be lower than in previous studies. In the Times Colonist, firearms brothers used for target practice in home videos likely Chinese replicas, says gun expert. Rod Giltaka, CEO and executive director of the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights, said the weapons were likely Norinco M305Bs, a Chinese copy of the Springfield Armory M14. Buying, selling, transporting, importing, or using the semi-automatic M14 has been banned in Canada since May 2020, along with about 1,500 variants of military-grade assault weapons. Isaac and Matthew Octorlone, both 22, died in a shootout with police after they attempted to rob a Bank of Montreal branch in Saanich on June 28th. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Blueberry Farmers of British Columbia. Last summer was too hot,
Last fall was too wet. Last spring was too cold. We appreciate your resilience in growing BC's favorite berry and can't wait to eat a whole bunch. It's BC Blueberry Day on July 15th. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 10th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 10th of July in 1991, the first elected president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, took office? In April 1993, Yeltsin came to Vancouver for a summit with Bill Clinton. Yeltsin's prime minister was a former spy named Vladimir Putin. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.